This evening, we're going to start a new study. It also takes a church. And there will be at least six sessions, depending on the discussion and other kinds of things that we in which we are engaged, as we think about not just it taking a village to raise children, but what is the possibility, or what are the church's roles, and beyond that, what are parents' roles, etc., in helping to train children and to prepare them to be productive and faithful members not only of society, but of the church. And there will be handouts each week. I won't be standing with my handout, but there'll be these kinds of handouts each week as we do our study, wondering about how we can help in raising children. Several years ago, as I said before, and as it begins here, there was a book written by, depending on your position, a famous or infamous person. It takes a village. The premise was that it takes an entire village, and I submit to that neighborhood, town, to really be involved in raising children, to be productive citizens. And I agree that families are the starting point, and families should be the starting point. Unfortunately, a lot of times, and we know this from experience not only socially but even religiously, a lot of times, especially these days, the parental responsibility for teaching and raising children is shifted to other places. In this country, we've talked before about when towns were built early on, the first building that was built and completed generally was in the center of the town, and that was the church, and then the town was built around it. And the church functioned, and the church building oftentimes functioned, not only as a place of religious instruction and worship, but also the place where town meetings were held, and oftentimes schools were either in that building or close by, those kinds of things. So the church played an integral role. Over time, a lot of times, the church has pushed all this other training off to other agencies and other groups rather than stepping up. And so, as I look around, I am more convinced than ever that our churches have a tremendous responsibility to help raise our children to be productive and compassionate citizens, not just productive. You can find that in 1984, the book, or Brave New World, without compassion, and other places without compassion. But I think we need to try to train folks to be productive and compassionate citizens. But part of that, I think, is to teach people in general, but children specifically, to become faithful and faith-filled members of the kingdom of God. Oftentimes in teaching religion classes in college, I will start my very first lecture in class by saying, you know, now most of you all here, because generally schools for whom I've taught are religiously oriented, and there are requirements you have to take at least two religion courses in order to graduate. And so I'll generally start talking about, most of you in here probably thinking, why in the world do I have to take this thing? You might have taken it as an elective, but because it's a required course, you don't want to take it. I've been in church all my life. Why do I need to do this? Just give me a test and let me pass it. Trust me, they won't. Had a few folks try that before. But then I tell them, you know, quite frankly, this class is important not just to meet the requirement, but it's important because we're going to be looking at the biblical text and the development of that and other things related to it. And if you think about it, regardless of what some people think, the Bible is, in my opinion, I think correctly, but then again, people can disagree and that's okay, the foundation for so much of living in the world, but especially Western society. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. It's been used both ways. The Bible is the most quoted and or paraphrased text, I think, still in history. Shakespeare comes in second. Although these days with Twitter and everything else, there's no telling what's going to rise to the top. You can find something, regardless of your major or your focus in life, something that touches or is touched upon in the biblical text. And regardless of what a lot of folks try to say these days, Western civilization, especially Western civilization's mores, laws, regulations for society, have a basis in Judeo-Christian writings and systems. Even those that sometimes misused the Judeo-Christian heritage. And so I think the church has an obligation to God and to the children and to our world to aid children in faith formation. Faith formation which may guide them today as well as for the future. And theirs and ours. And part of the study is based on some articles from the Center for Christian Ethics at Baylor University and a focus on children in several articles, as well as some other studies that in which I've been involved. So as we go, this is just kind of an overview tonight, as we go through this and as we start looking at this whole idea of it also takes a church to raise productive and compassionate citizens, but first we need to make them understand what it means to be a productive and compassionate citizen of the kingdom of God, in spite of what sometimes we do to them in church or with church, that we push forward and move forward in that direction. And I hope that there will be some give and take, some questions. I don't have all the answers here, trust me. But I hope there will be some give and take, some questions, some dialogue as we go along through the next several weeks. Robert Krushwitz, in an introduction to an article on the church and children, writes, "In Scripture and Christian tradition, we discover a rich picture of childhood that should inspire creative religious education for children in our families and faith communities and renewed commitment to serving all children." End of quote. And if you really think about it, there are a lot of stories in the Bible about children. You've got, of course, the children of Adam and Eve. You've got Abraham as a child of his father, Terah. You've got Abraham's children, and yes, that includes Ishmael, as well as Isaac. You have stories about children and families and brothers not always getting along and trying to beat the other one in the Jacob-Esau stories, and then subsequently in the Joseph sagas. You got Moses, as one little boy said one time, "What'd you learn in?" We learned about fighting in Egypt in the military during the time of Moses. Said, "Oh, really?" Said, "Yeah." And Moses, he hid out in the reeds and came out and led his armies. She said, "Oh, really? That's how?" Said, "Yeah. The story was about Moses and the bull rushers." But stories about a lot of children. Some of those good, some of those not so good. In the New Testament, we've got, of course, stories about children. And we've got the story, of course, the one we just finished talking about and celebrating, the birth of Jesus. But along with that, you've got the story of John the Baptizer. And you have that Jesus talking on many occasions about children and about how important children are, even to the point of saying, and while I think, yes, it does have a double meaning, it means children as in little children, when sometimes when he says, "Whoever causes one of these little children to stumble, it would be better for a millstone to be cast around his neck. But he's also talking about children of God, as in the disciples and others, when we are babes in understanding. Children are very important to Jesus. In the biblical text, especially in Deuteronomy and several other places, in the Exodus and in the book of Joshua, you've got God instructing things to take place and laws to be written and stones to be stacked as an altar so that when your children and your children's children ask, then you will teach them these lessons. You should study the law. You should put it on your forehead and in phylacteries and around your wrists and arms and paint it on your doorposts and teach your children and discuss it in the marketplace as well as at home and discuss it with your children. One of the things that we started doing some even more recently with Sydney is we bought a couple of little books of Bible stories. She's got a couple of Bibles and all, but for example, last night we had her unexpectedly, but it was a pleasant surprise, and had her for the night, and Grand Mary read to her from a Bible story book. Now, of course, she only made it halfway through the story and then she wanted another one, but at least getting that kind of thing. So Scripture and Christian tradition has a rich picture of children that we often overlook. But it should inspire us, as Krushvitz says, it should inspire us to a renewed commitment to serve our children, yes, but to serve all children. And I know we serve a lot of children on Wednesday evenings especially that are not our biological children, but over time, even some of those red-headed ones that we wondered if they'd ever slow down or we could ever get our voice back from saying, would you please stop? And then we drop the please. Still, we don't know what kind of... They're still, in some ways, our children, because which one of our children has ever been perfect all of the time? I won't even claim that I was, because I know I wasn't. Rodney Clapp writes, if we order our lives for the good of our children, though, we will be odd and out of step with our neighbors because we live in a society that cares little for the welfare of our children, right? In so many areas of our society, American culture, children are not on the front burner. And a lot of times, and I'm sorry this was my warped way of putting it here, we don't care so much about them until there's a mass killing of children. And then we get all in an uproar. And the children we don't even know, but because they're children. So much of our society pushes things the other way. I still am floored by some of the, you know, of course my boys had some and they bought some as they grew up, and I've been amazed that Stephen can buy some of these video games and he'll sit there for about 4 or 5 hours and he beats a whole game. You know, I couldn't even get past half the first level on it. But more and more violence that is out there. And this is what our children are doing. I really think that a lot of times we hear the tragic stories, not just things like Sandy Hook and Columbine and other places, but we hear the tragic story where just recently, I think it was a 7 or 8 year old that shot and killed a 2 year old. I can't remember if it was a sibling or a cousin. And somewhere in the story, you know, the gun went off, he shot, he expected him to get up. He didn't think it was final until it happened because he couldn't understand. And I think some of that is in part because of the development, the mental and emotional development of children, but also some of the movies and games and things that are out there. And you know, you can shoot, and then come back again and they're up. Right? So we are, in many ways, kind of out of step with a lot of folks when it comes to this kind of approach with children, and children being more a commodity. For some, children are more a commodity than anything else. So some of the questions in our study over the next several weeks here. How should we care for the children within our families and within our churches? Some of you have been surrogate parents for children. Some surrogate parents for children that didn't have parents that were around or that really cared. Some surrogate parents for children in different stages of their lives because they weren't getting along with their parents at the time, right? But they came to you. And how did they do that, or why did they do that? In part because of the connection that there was in the faith community. Some of you as Sunday school teachers, as GA leaders, as RA leaders, as leaders in choirs and on trips, as probably leaders in the BYPU from way, way back. And why did they do that? Because there was relationship. And I think that's where we really, as churches and as church people, it also takes a church as we start with relationship. Relationship. Relationship with children, but also relationship with parents. Relationship with those who are surrogate parents and even beyond. Another question that we'll deal with is, how do we view children? Marcia Bunge says that oftentimes in society, children are seen as commodities, consumers, or economic burdens. Anybody ever call them ankle binders? Just jokingly, I say, yeah, there go the ankle binders. Or as sinful creatures who are in some ways almost less than children. For example, on the one hand, you've got Jesus in Matthew chapter 18. Get over here. Verses 1 through 5. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called a child whom he put among them and said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." So on the one hand, we have a biblical view where children are gifts, not commodities, but gifts. Gifts not only to their parents, the children are gifts to the community as well. Children sometimes bring us simply joy. Luke chapter 1, verse 14, as the angel is speaking here. 1:14. "You will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth," talking to Zechariah about the birth of John the Baptist. In John chapter 16, verse 21, there are recognitions about sometimes there is pain, but there's also joy, and the pure joy of children. "When a woman is in labor, she has pain because her hour has come. But when her child is born, she no longer remembers the anguish because of the joy of having brought a child into the world." So on the one hand, we've got this biblical notion and this biblical understanding of children as gifts, not commodities. And yet in our world, we know that, unfortunately, there's a lot of human trafficking that involves children. There's a lot of abuse in various ways that involves children. But then in the biblical text, we also find that other side. Genesis chapter 8, verse 21. This is after Noah, they survived the flood, and Noah builds an altar, etc. "And when the Lord smelled the pleasing odor, the Lord said in his heart, I will never again curse the ground because of humans, for the inclination of the human heart is evil from its youth. Nor will I ever again destroy every living creature as I have done. So even the biblical text sometimes gives mixed messages, and it makes it more difficult sometimes for us. Psalm 51, verse 5. Indeed, I was born guilty, a sinner, when my mother conceived me. So for some, children are sinful, not quite human, and they need to be corrected, etc., as opposed to this sense of joy. What we need to be about is trying to find context and middle ground to understand that, yes, while we are yet sinners, Christ died for us, and yet at the same time, we are children of God who are adopted and who are lovable because of God and what God does for us and within us. And I know it won't surprise some of you that the Apostle Paul has something to say here. What then? Are we any better off? No, not at all, for we have already charged that all, both Jew and Greek, are under the power of sin. As is written, there is no one who is righteous, no, not even one, except for Jesus. So even Paul doesn't always have a positive understanding there. And so part of what we're trying to do is, how can we, not only as individuals, but we as a church, help to treat children and help not only others to understand, but to understand, help others to understand that children are more than commodities and they're more than just sinful things to be whipped into line. They're more than economic burdens. I haven't read in the last couple of years how expensive it is to raise a child from birth through college, but it's several hundred thousand dollars now, or a few hundred thousand dollars per child. But if we're going to help others understand this, where do we have to start? With ourselves. With ourselves as individuals, but even more so with ourselves as a church. Another thing, what can we learn from children? Out of the mouths of babes and sucklings, you have perfected praise. But are there other things that we can learn from children? Even learn spiritually from children. How does the gospel commission us to serve the needs of children who are beyond our families and our churches? What did Jesus say about those who are beyond us? You know, we oftentimes think and take the Great Commission as go into all the world out there, and we generally say go into all the world, instead of we kind of skip over and make disciples. The church for far too long has go into the world and get them baptized, get them saved and baptized and in the church, and then we can keep on going out adding to the numbers. But how can we serve, and we oftentimes think of those as we got to get them as teenagers and up. On the other extreme, you got the churches that baptize them when they're infants and never take them any further. Although technically many of those are supposed to have confirmation classes, catechetical classes around the time they hit puberty to try and get them to reaffirm that and understand the church. Some don't. And there I've even got a few colleagues in other denominations who will say, we baptize them as infants, and even if they don't make that decision later on to confirm that, if something happens to them, as long as it's not a mortal sin, they're still covered. And how do we teach people even beyond that there has to be more to it than that to serve the needs of the children? First in our families, but then beyond our families. I'm trying to remember right now, and I can't call up his name, but I can see him, the little red-headed. Yes, thank you. Uh-oh, a lot of people tossed that name out there, didn't they? Just like that. And yet, folks, for y'all who don't know, and I only was in and out of here some when Eli was around, but you know, you got that old Three Dog Night song? Eli's coming. Eli's coming. And it was warning when Eli was coming. I'm surprised that every year there for a while, I'm surprised that for a few years, they didn't automatically have a hurricane or a tornado named Eli every year. When it came to the E, it was going to be Eli. And yet, not too often long ago, Eli was back here visiting, and Eli was just as calm and mannerly as he could be. Now, don't know if that's because somebody had a big old strop, as they used to say, somewhere out yonder. But I would hope and pray that at least somewhere deep down inside, Eli is that way because of something that was said or done here other than popping him in the back of the head. How do we touch and serve the needs of those beyond our own families and sometimes beyond our own churches? And I think that that's something that is all the more needed. We do some things on a much smaller scale, but where do we stop? Can we stop? Really? But you have to start one at a time. You can't save them all at once. Right. But you have to be committed, I think. And that's part of this is what does the gospel say to us, and then how do we put that into motion? How do we put legs and feet to that? I think we do some of that, but how can we do it even more?
There's a lot, but not a lot, but there are failures in that foster system, and there's some that they just have to let go back. You know, but I think it's important because they keep trying, they don't keep saying it didn't work, so they don't quit.
Which is a challenge. It's a challenge for all kinds of resources, not only financial, but people. Sanity sometimes seems to suffer. And, you know, I think it's also a little bit interesting, not wanting to make anybody mad or upset, it's also a little interesting that the majority, we have a pretty full room in here, and the majority of us are about old enough to be the parents, if not old enough to be the parents of the two youngest ones in this room. Yeah, I'm talking about. Debbie and Susan. And yet, I'm hopeful, you know, and some of us sitting in here may, and I'm not trying to put words in anybody's mouth either, but or thoughts in your head, other than maybe somehow we can do some things that will help others, other than the two of you, to join us in this kind of thing over the next several weeks, even if they pop in and out. But how do we, who some of whom are retired and a year or two older, and have raised families, and have helped raise grands, and those who have served, who may be a year or two older, and have helped to raise children who are not biological, but have been students of theirs in Sunday school and music and other things, and who maybe sometimes we feel, well, what more can I do? Because I did that. How can we, maybe what we can do is to partner with other folks to help parents parent to help children learn to be inviting and make church a safe place. Just things to think about. And I don't have any definitive answers on how to do that. It has to be a collaborative effort. Well, you're still your parents' children. I said yesterday something about we were Stephen and Lynn were hosting with some others a baby shower for our best friend's son and daughter-in-law who are having a baby very soon, and that's how we ended up with Sydney, because Sydney, we got ready to leave, she said, "But I want to go with you." And we said, "Well, it's just for tonight. We church tomorrow. We got to bring you back." And Allie, the little girl you play with, Allie's not going. And this four and a half, not even four and a half yet, looked up and said, "I don't care about any of that. I want to go with you." What 4.5-year-old says, "I don't care about any of that." But, you know. And then she gets these big, droopy eyes. So, yeah. So how can you turn that down? But anyway, there was conversation going on with some of the friends there, Stephen and Lynn. I said something about children. They said, "You must be talking about Stephen." I said, "Well, yeah, Stephen will soon be 37 years old, but he'll always be my child." But not necessarily by age, because there are those who, for various reasons, are children even into 20s and 30s. But at the same time, where do we draw the line, and where do we start? And I think, quite frankly, we start as young as we can. But if there are those who have been missed and overlooked, we have to find or look for ways to plug into some of those folks, teenagers, preteens. Yes, Connie. Go ahead.
Sometimes it's just our presence and our availability, like the children that come here on Wednesday night.
Right.
It had been many years since I had worked with children in music, and so I felt a little trepidation getting back into that. But just being with them here for 30 minutes on Wednesday night, they communicate, to me what they need, whether it's
right.
A hug or whatever it is, you know, just being with them, getting to know them, talking to them, you learn very quickly what they need from you.
Right, you do, by being present. And that's why I said a while ago, it's about relationship. And relationship's not always... relationship is not... Really, the best relationship is not, "I'm looking down on you and it's a top-down thing," but relationship is we share together on the same plane. I know that Gene has connected with some of them as well, and they've connected with Mr. Gino. Gino the Genie. We could dub you that way. You could work miracles with some of these children. We'll start calling you Gino the Genie. Get you your own lamp. We'll get you your own lamp to sit up on a shelf. It is very special when they get grown and they become more friend or as much friend, but there's still moments where they are still child. And the unfortunate thing is there are so many children out there, and there are a number of those children that come here on Wednesday nights and occasionally show up on Sunday for a musical, and sometimes they don't, who are lacking some of that connection. And so being present, I think that's very good, you know. Among the questions are children being raised with love and affection, and how can we help? Are they safe in their homes? Are they safe in their schools? I'm just glad, or maybe I'm just not watching enough. I know I hadn't been watching a whole lot of the news here lately. Things have been so hectic. But I'm just glad that there has been a respite. Unless y'all have seen something, you let me know, you can burst my bubble. There has been a respite in turning the news on and finding somebody, a music minister, a youth minister, a priest, a pastor, or somebody that had been molesting children. It seemed like there for a while, about every other day, you saw that, and there's been just a short period here. But that's another thing. How do we make our churches safe? There are a number of things. The unfortunate thing is that more and more people are making suggestions, and we do a basic background check, but background checks not just on staff, but for anybody that works with children. And that's a sad thing for churches. But then again, if there were a perfect church on this earth, it'd be empty. Because humans aren't perfect. But that's not an excuse. That means we've got that much more work to do. And I'm going to run over here. Yes, Max. Did you give him the recipe?
No.
Okay. Well, I noticed, I did see on the news last night that one of the school systems is not only going to be offering breakfast and lunch, but is also going to be offering supper for those children who don't get supper at home in the school system. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. How do we do that? And will children have a faith which can and will be lived out in service and compassion? If we don't live it, if we don't teach them that, if they don't get shown that through relationship, etc., if we don't foster it, they won't. Odds are that they won't. And then questions, questions, questions. We continue to have questions as we go. There are different themes for the study. Discovering more vibrant theological influence of Jesus' human family, because he text says that he grew and became full of wisdom. Reflecting on the suffering of the Christ child, read an interesting article in this Baylor study that said we focus on the suffering of the Christ man, but it's not until we look also at the suffering of the Christ child. And we don't often think of it that way. But, as I recently said, if you really look at it and think about it, Jesus was born, somebody tried to kill him right off. Family had to pick up and move, like migrants. Around. So, until we understand something of the suffering of the Christ child, we can't really understand the full picture and how children suffer and what we can do to help there. And some other ways that we learn to teach and influence them with a deeper knowledge of the Bible. We got to start out, and we know that certain ages they can only understand so much. But when a child gets 8, 9, 10 years old and they've been in church and they're still hearing the story of Jonah and the whale like they did when they were 3 years old, that's actually a lack of respect for the child. Think about it. That's actually a lack of respect for the child because you're thinking that the child is no further along than a 3-year-old. That's also, that and some other things I think are part of the reason why I get 18, 19, 20, and sometimes 40-year-old students who don't have a clue about the stories anymore, much less what they mean. And they mix them up. I had a student probably 15 years ago wanted to do an extra credit paper. And she'd done it, and I offered everybody the option to do something for extra credit. She was going to do one. It was Old Testament class. She was struggling. She was going to do one on Joseph. And I said, well, What's the theme? She said, well, the Joseph and the influence as he grew, the influence that he had on other people. I said, okay. Well, I sat down to read this paper, this 10-page paper, which consisted of about 7 pages of quotes of the Bible just strung together and not properly footnoted. But I found out something amazing. Joseph's longevity, there must have been something in that sarcophagus and they raised him back up. Joseph's longevity was so tremendous it wasn't even funny, because his greatest accomplishment, the same Joseph that was sold by his brothers into slavery, his greatest accomplishment was that God chose him to be the earthly father of Jesus and raised Jesus. And this student was raised in church and was 22 years old when this paper was written. How do we help children grow instead of keeping them back? And then what are ways that we can parent, grandparent, surrogate parent children in not only hopeful ways, but hope-filled ways to give them a sense of hope? On the back, well, it was on the back, but of y'all's it is. I got separate sheets. I want to end this evening, generation to generation. Not something new, but I just liked this, and if you wonder where this came from, it appeared in a recent South Carolina CBF publication. In a house which becomes a home, one hands down and another takes up the heritage of mind and heart, laughter and tears, musings and deeds. Love, like a carefully loaded ship, crosses the gulf between the generations. Therefore, we do not neglect the ceremonies of our passage. When we wed, when we die, and when we are blessed with a child, when we depart and when we return, when we plant and when we harvest, let us bring up our children. It is not the place of some official to hand to them their heritage. If others impart to our children our knowledge and ideals, they will lose all of us that is wordless and full of wonder. That one, that statement just kind of hit me in the gut when I read it. If others impart to our children our knowledge and ideals, they will lose all of us that is wordless and full of wonder. Let us build memories in our children, lest they drag out joyless lives, lest they allow treasures to be lost because they have not been given the keys. We live not by things, but by the meanings of things. It is needful to transmit the passwords from generation to generation. And by the way, this is posted on the bulletin board outside church office, and it'll probably end up being posted in some other places around to serve as a reminder that if we don't do it, and if we don't do it together, then children will lose the treasures because we haven't given them the keys. They'll lose all of us that is wordless and full of wonder, relationship and presence. Yeah, I ran over. Surprise, surprise. I really thought this was going to be a short session. But thank you all for your input and for your questions. And next week, we'll talk about how do we develop kind of a growing and living, vibrant theology, understanding of children from the standpoint of God. God bless you. Go in peace, and I look forward to our time together. Amen.